Can probiotics prevent type 1 diabetes?
Do school food policies improve nutrition?
How many cancer cases can we attribute to inheritance?
And the full disclosure about cancer screening.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 8th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. And Happy New Year, Elizabeth.
Happy New Year to you. As you remember, last week we posted on January 1st, although we weren't actually present for that. Rick, why don't we turn first to this issue from the Journal of the American Medical Association. Just in the last couple months, we reported a study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine taking a look at pediatric cancers and what percentage of those could be accounted for by what were called germline mutations. And it was a low number. It was only 8 to 10%. Now this study is taking a look at, hey, what percentage of cancer cases are due to inherited mutations? And it turns out it's a much higher number.
And this is important for what we call cancer risk prediction. One of the predictive factors is thought to be family history. Does somebody in your family, most importantly, in the first degree relatives, mother, father, or importantly, a sibling have cancer? And does that increase your risk? And is it true across all cancers or just across certain cancers? And one way to address that is to look at twins. To do that, we have to have a large database of twins that have been followed for a long period of time, 30 or 40 or 50 years. The Norwegian countries have that. We have a Nordic database in which there have been over 200,000 twins embedded within the population that have been followed for an average of about 32 years. Among these twins, some of which are identical, called monozygotic, some of which are not identical, called dizygotic, then we have the general population. So we're able to tease out, using some statistical methods, what the inheritability is for identical twins, the non-identical, and then the general population. And what they found was, as you alluded to, there was about a 33% of the cancer risk among these monozygotic twins was in fact heritable. So here's the interesting thing. There's a general prevalence in the population. It increases about 6% absolute in dizygotic twins and about 14% absolute increase among identical twins. But sometimes the identical twins didn't inherit the same type of cancer. They had a cancer, but it was a different type of cancer. That occurred in about 60 to 70% of the twins. That suggests there's some sort of a genetic predisposition, and there's some interaction with the environment as well. Things like obesity and smoking, exposure to alcohol, environmental behaviors also influence. So this was a terrific study because it was so large and encompassed decades of follow-up.
Clearly, the idea is that, wow, if we can identify these things, then we can say, hello, early in life, you are at risk for a specific type of cancer. In the short term, of course, increase vigilance in looking for that kind of cancer, but also advise about behaviors and potentially at some point advise about strategies for treatment.
And so where there is that genetic and environmental interaction, these are potentially preventable cancers. If you know that you're at risk, for example, a skin cancer, and that's one of those that has an increased risk of heritability, exposure to sun can be decreased to decrease your risk. The cancers that had significant heritability were skin cancers, prostate cancer, kidney cancer, breast cancer, and uterine cancer.
We're going to be seeing, of course, a lot more about this because these studies assessing someone's genome have declined so much in price and increased in ease that I think one of these days we're all going to have such a profile.
And then we're going to have to be able to interpret that correctly. So that's time for another discussion.
Okay. Let's turn then to JAMA Pediatrics. A couple things I thought were very provocative. And in point of fact, this one I find incredibly intriguing. Probiotics, something we've talked about a number of times on podcasts. Hey, what is that? This collection of, let's call it largely gut flora that can be taken. And reducing the risk for type 1 diabetes in children who are at risk to develop this condition.
We've talked before about the fact that probiotics have been hypothesized to actually influence the immune system. And specifically, they do it by modifying the response to environmental exposures to healthy individuals, how these bacteria enter the gut and whether they prevent bacteria from getting from the gut into the system and how they interact with the environment. And it's been hypothesized that early exposure to probiotics can actually beneficially affect the immune system. Now, we know that type 1 diabetes is an immune-related disease. People have a genetic predisposition. They develop an immune response to their pancreas. That immune response ends up killing the pancreas, or at least the islet cells that make insulin, and people get diabetes. They do it early in life. So the question is, does early introduction of probiotics in an infant's diet, can it affect the immune system and decrease type 1 diabetes? These investigators looked at 6 clinical centers in which we had a dietary evaluation. We knew what the parents were giving their children. And it's interesting because in Europe, they give them probiotics. In the U.S., that's less prevalent. And then they collected blood samples over the next several years of the child's life, looking for antibodies to the islet cells in the pancreas. And what they discovered is that among over 8,600 children that had a predisposition to developing diabetes, those that received probiotics early in life within the first 27 days had a 34% decreased risk of developing antibodies to the pancreas that would subsequently lead to diabetes. So their conclusion was that the early probiotic supplement in specific genotypes can actually decrease the risk of developing type 1 diabetes.
A most intriguing finding, I must admit, and certainly suggests to me that a prospective study potentially utilizing this strategy would be a good practical thing to undertake. Does it also suggest that in people who have a family history of type 1 diabetes, that this genotyping might be a really important thing?
That's an important point because they looked at a number of different genotypes, and it was only in one specific genotype did probiotics seem to help. It reduced the risk 60% in that particular genotype. What was it in the probiotics that influenced it? Are there different things that we can introduce into the gut that might help different genotypes? This requires confirmation and follow-up.
Most intriguing. I find it quite interesting. Let's stay in JAMA Pediatrics then and look at the positive impact of a huge program undertaken to improve nutrition in kids.
This was a national program that was embarked upon in the United States in 2010 as a result of what's called the Healthy Hungry Free Kids Act. We have been providing breakfast and lunch to children that could not afford it for a number of years. In 2010, school diets were changed so that they had specific calories for each grade, particular portions and sizes, and they included more fruits and vegetables, whole grain, rich grains, no whole milk, and they reduced the sodium. 3 years later, it actually improved the nutritional intake and was it sustainable, or did the kids turn away from that? These authors looked at over 1.7 million school meals held at 3 middle schools and 3 high schools. There are 7,200 students that enrolled in the district. What they discovered was kids selected foods that were higher in nutrient value and less in terms of their energy density. Although the kids initially complained about the changes in the diet, 2 or 3 years later, they were perfectly fine with it and kids did not drop out from it.
Gosh, I bet sometimes you wish that somebody would just completely provide you with all of your stuff. You wouldn't have to think about it. If it resulted in better nutrition, that would just be a win-win all over.
It clearly results in better nutrition in school. What we don't know is, as they leave school, will that have a continued effect?
Finally then, let's turn to a rather sobering publication in the British Medical Journal. Gosh, with all this cancer screening, what's the truth behind that? Are we really helping?
We'll leave it to the Brits to provide controversy to something that we accept as dogma, and that is that cancer screening is beneficial, and specifically, cancer screening reduces mortality. They do not argue with the fact that cancer screening may decrease cancer-specific mortality. But what they do argue is there is very little, if any, evidence that cancer screening reduces overall mortality. And how did they arrive at that? They looked at the randomized trials of cancer screening and meta-analysis of cancer screening. What they determined was that none of the studies showed an overall reduction in mortality. People still died, and they still died about the same time. Why is that? That's because they die of things that they would have died of otherwise, and cancer screening doesn't prevent that. Also, there are some harms associated with cancer screening. Overdiagnosis, additional procedures that can have harm, it leads to additional therapy, and sometimes people die of the therapy rather than the cancer. What they argue is not that there shouldn't be cancer screening, but we should do a better job of informing patients about what we know, because when they poll patients and physicians and they ask, does cancer screening save lives? The majority of people say, oh, yes, it does. And they overestimated the magnitude of that. So what these particular investigators do is they provide a box. And in that box, they say, if we screen for cancer, how many cancer deaths are predicted to be prevented? Does it reduce overall mortality? Yes or no? And if so, by how much? And what's the absolute benefit one can expect to receive? And with that, the patient can decide whether they want to be involved or not.
But as we talked about last week, gosh, you know, with low value screening, when patients are presented with facts, we've become, as patients, so brainwashed into this is the right thing to do that I'm not sure that strategy is going to have much of an impact.
Well, your point's well taken. I think you and I would both agree that we want patients to be better informed and we want them to be a part of the decision-making process. And that has to at least start with getting the facts straight. Their analysis shows that, gosh, there doesn't appear to be a significant amount of data showing that cancer screening saves lives, but we overestimate that. So we've got to start somewhere.
All right. On that sort of sobering note, I am going to feature the probiotics in type 1 diabetes this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.